but after a couple hundred feet, and probably way less than 1,000 feet, your squishy body meeting water is the equivalent of hitting concrete.
So at this point, you were really taken out of the movie. This was also the worst thing in the movie.
This, again, is where the science breaks down.
I'm sorry, but they should have died.
I know. Again, before, like, you know, anything, like, really gets anywhere, he's saying, like,
your dad offered me a bunch of money, gave me all this stuff to offer me so he can get this mineral from these people, and I'm gonna throw myself into a volcano. And she's like, what?
He's like, you're not gonna make me repeat all that again. And she's, like, trying to process all of this. And he's like, well, say something. And she's like, you tell me you're dying. You tell me you're jumping into a volcano. My mind is a blank. And I'm like, statement of the movie!
Yeah. It's true.
And then she goes to bed.
She goes, is it catching? And he's like, no. But here's the thing. When he was making out with Dee Dee earlier, and he goes, I'm dying, it's not catching.
Yeah.
It's the same word. Same, probably because it's the same author.
Right.
But she thought to ask it after he told her.
Right.
Without trying to kiss her or anything.
Right.
And then she's like, well, then I guess I'm going to bed.
Yeah.
She nopes out of there. She's like, I gotta process. You can tell she's a person who has to process.
These are very, like, if you were getting hot and heavy with someone and then they just broke out, like, by the way, I'm going to die in 6 months. I mean, I don't know how I would react in that kind of a situation, but it would definitely change the mood.
She's mouthed into the microphone. I'm just saying. That was awesome. Oh, man. Okay. So now we're coming to our first climax. We've got like two major climaxes and then...
A storm hits and there's this typhoon and what is it? Joe wakes up. He goes and talks to... I think it's Amanda...
Are you talking about Dagmar?
Yes.
I only call her the So I Killed...
Married an Axe Murderer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I Married an Axe Murderer Lady.
Yeah. So she's like the captain of the ship and he's.
I think she's the navigator.
Oh, the navigator. Okay.
Yeah, because or engineer, because she works the engine. You see her at the navigation station. She goes, a monsoon is coming.
Yeah.
And I really like, it's kind of cast off because like you get swept up in the monsoon part. But like there is this whole part with where Meg is standing on the bow of the ship.
She has like her one leg just like right, like it's like at a close to a 90 degree angle from the other leg.
Yes, it's very much a pirate stance. She looks like the Captain Morgan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the lighting is very Wicked Witch of the East because it's all green and she's in her pajamas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like looking out and Joe comes up behind her and he's like, what's going on? And she's like, we're going to have a monsoon. And I think Dagmar might have mentioned that before, mm-hmm. earlier, before he came out to where she was staring out into the water.
Right.
And he's like, what is even a monsoon? And she goes, and the wind rustles her hair. And she's like, well, Joe, I think you're about to find out.
Yeah. And that's when the storm really kicks up and like she's calling on
a Mayday distress signal. And she says it twice and it's not getting through. She says, you go check on Dagmar. Dagmar's down in the hull working on the engine. Mm-hmm. And he's like, is everything okay? She's like, it's fine. I want you to go take care of Patricia. So he runs back up. Patricia's dressed in her yellows and her wellies and she's got a rope strapped mm-hmm. around her chest. No, that's not true.
She slams
down the receiver.
Right.
Dude pops in and says, hey, the bulkhead's going to go.
Yeah.
And she's...
She goes off the screen.
Uh-huh.
And then Joe like tries to like lock the latch because he's like, oh, we got to protect ourselves. And she comes back in. He's like, what are you doing? And she's got the rope around her. And she's like, it's my boat.
So she goes out and what they're trying to do is he goes out after her in his ill-advised outfits. From Fashion Week, and they're trying to secure the mast, the part that hangs off the mast. Somebody who has touched a boat, tell me what that is.
It's the log that goes swinging 360 degrees.
The mainstay.
Okay.
I think it's called a mainstay. You got the mast, and the mainstay is where the sail comes up down. Okay, so they're trying to secure that because it's just swinging wildly, and they don't want anybody to get, like, hit.
That's important for later.
That's a treat we'll enjoy later.
Because they stop and then...
He gets knocked down and she runs over and says, are you okay? And they stand up.
Their eyes lock.
He pushes the brim of her hat up so she looks like Paddington frickin' Bear.
And the music swells as they go in for a kiss.
And they do. And here's the thing. I cannot fault Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks when they kiss.
No.
I will judge almost everyone. And I do. And I will stare. And their kisses, I mean, it's cute. Mm-hmm. It's not too much.
Right.
And it's kind of been precursored a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, when it comes, it shows up just about on time, I would say. And so then they back up from each other and they're just like, well, that's a thing that happened. We're a thing now. Who knew that would be a thing? And then
there's this moment where I'm like, you don't stop in the middle of a storm to make out, because if you do, it's going to go down.
Yeah. Our mainstay. I'm going to lock into that. It's totally what it's called, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally.
Our mainstay did the opposite of its name and sub-charactered are gone now.
Right. It just goes swinging and it flings Patricia off the boat.
I officially named this scene Smackers and Smacked off the boat. It's right there. You can read it in my notes. Smackers and Smacked off the boat.
Off the boat is in parentheses, by the way.
Yeah.
It is. And so, like, Joe's like on the side of the boat watching, seeing Patricia as she like goes into the water and she's floating away.
He has to dive down twice into the water to try to find her. And the second time he does it, he kicks his legs really hard and it looks super like Kermit the Frog flipping down into the water. I approve of that.
Yes.
He finds her.
And he like brings her up in like the worst way possible.
He holds her in what I would not initially. He holds her. He comes up holding both of her hands above the water, so it's like she's doing an opposite dive. and then he does a lifeguard hold that's pretty close to accurate, although I don't think you're supposed to come up their armpit, because if you're under their armpit, if they start flailing their arms, they're going to knock you down. Mm-hmm. So you kind of hold them by the neck, if I remember right, but I could be wrong. So here's the thing. Don't take your lifeguarding advice from a podcast, guys. Go take a class. I took a class and I've forgotten it, so I should take a second class.
Right.
Thanks. PSA brought to you by Shocked and Applaud. He turns with her to look back at the boat, and our long-awaited moment has arrived.
We get a lightning bolt.
You'd be surprised. It feels so familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've seen it somewhere before.
Right.
Like it's wide at the bottom, and it jags away from you. It almost looks like the crack in his bedroom wall.
Or the path that he took.
The logo of the business he works in.
Yeah.
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 Just, it's too many times.
Yeah.
It needs to be a little softer.
Over the head. It's, repeatedly.
Yeah. So the boat sinks. Guys.
Because I got hit by lightning.
Yes. And then, although they are what appears to be at least a couple hundred yards away from this boat that has just gone down.
Mm-hmm. We see this luggage just plop right up.
Boop.
Bloop.
Boop.
Bloop.
Now, these chests are so big that he manages to get Meg Ryan, I should call her Patricia. Joe gets Patricia onto one of these chests and then has the rope around. Okay, so you know how I like to logic these things out.
Mm-hmm.
They had the rope because she had it around her when she helped him stand up and then she got knocked into the water.
Right.
She is laying on this chest. Her jacket is off of her. It is draped over her. And in order to do that, he took the rope off and put it on him, and that's why he has the rope now.
Right.
So somehow he passes out, holds on to the makeshift raft, and somehow, now it's daylight. It was dark before. We have had, I mean, let's say it happened in the middle of the night, right? But from darkness to lightness, like completely bright, you're talking at least a couple hours. Tell me how those chests stayed in the Pacific Ocean, which you know Scott's currents because you took a class. How those all stayed close enough that he could get all four of his chests together. Okay, maybe it's a useless rant, but like it still makes me so mad.
It would have made just about as much sense if they all plopped up at the same place and they were all around him and then he could have like grabbed them at that point.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because at least like the logic is there about what he's going to do. He's going to lash them together with a rope.
Yeah, he's going to make a luggage raft with this awesome steamer trunk luggage that he got from one of the best characters I've ever seen in any movie.
Yes, so. Whose name we don't know.
No, don't know the actor, don't know the character. All we know is that he's the great luggage guy.
I mentioned in my notes, no one will be seated during the castaway reenactment.
My note was, Tom Hanks does make being stranded and surrounded by the ocean fun.
My notes then go say, what is up with, and then I dot, dot, dotted this entire movie. And then I thought of, okay, so he goes about the necessary tasks of taking care of an unconscious for what the internet says is several days. Yeah. It's not just a day and a half, which it looks like in the movie. They say several days. And he ex machina'd himself beautifully with this. Like, yeah. He's got this luggage and all of the useless shit that he thought he, because he didn't know if he was going to be in a hut or whatever. He thought he was going to be on the island for several days. Mm-hmm. So he bought kerosene lamps that were posh and happened to be in his luggage. Mm-hmm. He brought an umbrella, which is great because now they're exposed to the sun and the elements. And now he's got, my favorite thing is the violin case, wet bar.
Yeah.
Violin case, wet bar that happens to have Perrier in it. So now he, by the capful, is doling out water to her over a period of time. But also he was being a ridiculous man. So he also has a golf set that blows away eventually that he's playing with on top of these chests.
Applauders, this is probably the, 157th montage in this movie so far.
It starts with him pulling out the radio and he starts to dance. And it's half dad dance, half crazy dance. And I'm going to put another half on there because we need a 150 on this.
It's all Tom Hanks, though.
It is 100%, 150% Tom Hanks. He raises his hands again in thanks to the Lord.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And I have made fire.
My gosh.
And he like pulls out a ukulele, sings this like cowboy song that was written by the writer of this movie.
He definitely sings one of two songs written for the film, mm-hmm. the lullaby one being the other one, mm-hmm. and this one. He's actually, Tom Hanks is pretty good. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he could still play the ukulele. Or, and this is my daydream after watching it, I was like, what if I played this song for Tom Hanks? Would he join in or would he give me pointers on how to be better? It doesn't matter. He would love it.
And he has like mild hallucinations of the stars where he sees the constellations in the stars.
Yeah, there's a couple instances of a little tiny touch of animation.
Right.
And that's one of them.
The sun beats down and then we see this beautiful moonrise where the moon is just like so large.
Mm, he's sunburned. He's dehydrated. He hasn't been drinking any water himself. Mm-hmm. And you can only go about 3 days. You can only go about 3 days without water.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know how long it's been, but he looks beleaguered. He's covered in like
blisters.
Yeah. He's sunburned, he's ragged, he's unkempt, and he raises his hands to the sky for the third or the fourth time.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks directly to the moon
and he's like, to the name of God, I do not know, thank you for my life.
I didn't know
it was so beautiful.
Yes, he's super thankful, and then he falls to his knees and then falls to his side. He's pretty close to the end, and then all of a sudden angelically, hey,
Joe, why didn't you take any water for yourself? Patricia is up and she looks pristine.
She looks unflawed. He has watched over her like a mommy bird.
Like did her makeup, brushed her hair.
Yeah, she's just like, Joe, you look terrible. I don't know if she says that, but she might as well.
Oh, and guys, this is where it gets really, really, really cringy.
Oh my god.
When the cringe starts and it kind of just lingers there in the background for the rest of the movie.
Oh my god.
Because they get spotted by the natives of Waponi Woo. And it is just like, it's such an exaggeration of the way that indigenous people were portrayed in like the very earlier parts of cinema. Just like this huge exaggeration of it that I think the director was trying to be like, kind of make fun of it, trying to make us know that this isn't meant to be taken seriously. But
there's a big old but in there, because even if you describe them as this Jewish, Druidic, Latin, Celtic,
yeah,
race that mixed with people in the Polynesian island, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just... And the funny thing is they all love orange soda.
You know, it would have been a great way of just kind of curbing away from some of these more pernicious stereotypes. Mm. If they had just made the natives very, like, kitschy American. Like, they really... Like, okay, so in the logic of the movie, they have had a relationship with this guy who needs the mineral on the island. And they've probably, you know, like mind as they've gone, and they've given him what they feel he probably earns. And they probably are, I mean, I would almost think that they would be somewhat savvy to go ahead and, because this guy's super rich, he would be willing to pay a lot of money for it. And so, or maybe like if they give it to him, then he like gives them not just a soda, but like stuff from America. And then they just really like American things. And
yeah,
it still would be weird because you have a white man coming into the native culture.
Yeah.
Once
you get a little woke, being invasive in other people's culture has a particular stink to it.
Yeah.
Here's what I think they were trying to say. He was like, I can't get in with them because they eat fruit and fish all day, and it's a nice, beautiful tropical island. They don't need anything I have, so they keep flipping me the bird, but I need this boomeroo or whatever. He has figured out that the only commodity he can give them that will get him anything is Joe in terms of a sacrifice. So that being said, they're supposed to be essentially untouched as a culture, except that they love orange soda and they're all of these different things.
Right.
Different races.
Right.
I think that was supposed to be the joke that like they don't. Okay, guys, I'm going to describe these people and you have to forgive me because I'm the aesthetics explainer of Shocked and Applaud.
Sure you don't want me to go ahead and explain it because I chose this movie. I feel like I need to own this movie.
Okay, no, here's the thing. Everything can be the worst. So this is not the worst. It's just pretty bad.
Yeah.
These are a collection of persons with non-super white skin.
Yeah.
Who are dressed in parodies or homages of Pacific Islander Polynesian persons' traditional dress mixed with the colors and remnants of orange Fanta cans just everywhere.
Yeah.
They love it so much and it's everywhere. And what I think we should focus on is not the, and this is okay, it's coming from a white person, so please like forgive me already, but like we're supposed to focus on the ridiculousness of it and not be freaking out about the fact that we have a major motion picture from like 1990 where they were like, you slightly brown, you don't mind putting on a grass skirt. You want to have this ridiculous Fanta headgear? It's hilarious. No, no, don't worry. Nathan Lane's going
to
be there.
Yeah. Nathan Lane is like the person who's supposed to, he's their concierge. That's what I wrote it down as. And like they do some kind of exaggerated things. I mean, obviously.
They spot them on their little makeshift raft and they full on do boats that I saw in Moana. You're like, oh, Pacific Islander, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure those types of boats were on a majority of these Pacific islands. So, like, it's just this particular culture is supposed to be this thing set apart.
Right. You get the exaggerationness. Like, they literally roll out a red carpet. And it's, like, a big honking red carpet.
Yo, is that what that
was? Yeah. They're literally, I mean, like, and that was something
I was like, what is that big thing? And now that you say it, it looks like bamboo that's been painted red that's been rolled up. And now it's a red carpet. That is hilarious. Oh, my God.
But I think that was the mindset of the people trying to make this. They didn't do it maliciously. There was a lot of ignorance in it, though.
Yes.
Like, their costumings, it's just, like, grass skirts. They got, like, flattened orange soda cans as necklaces.
They kind of look like those plates of tiles that are often used in a lot of native dress. And, like, they've got face paint on, too.
Yeah.
Which, you know, speaks directly to specific cultures. And they, let's just go on with the plot.
They move Joe and Patricia over to meet the chief, and the chief is played by Abe Vigoda. And then, like, he comes out, we see, like, the camera focus on just, like, you know, his torso for the time being, and then he pulls out this wooden doll. I mean, everybody's kind of, like, standing up, and as soon as you hear the doll come out, you hear, like, stuff ruffling in the background, and the next shot...
It goes back to Joe and Patricia,
and everybody else is just flat on the ground.
Yes, with their hands over their faces. So I don't know if they did that to make like staging easier. They're like, we're gonna knock out this scene in like an hour, but you guys just all lay in the same place with your hands over your face.
Right.
Like that would be easy to maintain continuity.
Mm-hmm.
But they never explain it. He just pulls out his doll and they're all on the ground except for them. And they're like, what's that? And he's like, it's my soul.
And they're like, I hope you don't lose that. And he's like, so do I.
He's like, here's what's going to happen. We're going to have a feast tonight, and afterwards, you're going to walk yourself into that volcano. Cool?
Abe Vigoda is just deadpan. He's like, I just need to get through this. Like like us, he is the audience.
Yes, yes, I'm going to say that.
Yeah.
As much as Nathan Lane tries to sell the over-the-topness, Abe Vigoda is just fair. I think he understood the humor of the moment better.
Mm-hmm.
It's If I could have, maybe I'll rant about that at the end. No, maybe I'll say it now. If Eugene Levy and Gene Wilder had a hold of this film, it would have been like 10 times better.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's like saying, you know what? You know what would make this Funfetti cake mix better? If Gordon Ramsay had cooked it.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah. So, and then they go into another montage of Joe and Patricia being taken care of.
they're getting dolled up for the feast. Mm-hmm. And it's the last duck we see is standing on a chest in one of these montage-y scenes.
Yeah. Joe's pretty much getting like cleaned up and the guys are taking care of Joe and the ladies are taking care of Patricia. There's a huge distinction between the 1655th montage that we've seen in the movie so far.
Give or take one or two, I think.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah. I think I'm getting my numbers right on that. Mm-hmm. I'm always good at numbers. Anyways, so Joe is like getting beat up. He's like getting.
And they're
like,
dumping water on him really hard.
Yeah.
And like.
They smash a banana in his face.
And once somebody comes up with a pile of powder and just goes, and everybody around him laughs. They're like, this is funny. You're killing yourself for us, but this is funny. Yeah. And then you cut back to Meg and they're like, her hands in like a conch shell and they're like brushing her fingers with a.
So delicate.
With a flower. Mm-hmm. And they're like, they adorn her with bells and they like have her in a fancy sarong. He's sitting naked on a rock.
Yeah.
And somebody's doing her nails. The ladies are all around her going, oh no, not everything's the Little Mermaid. But they're all like,
yeah. Okay, there's this, like, the whole language that they use throughout this entire third act for the natives is just, it's just gibberish.
Is it?
It doesn't sound like, it sounds made up to me.
Nathan Lane's stuff sound pretty solid when he's doing the ceremony later.
I don't know. Like, I hear them saying, like, kemosabe a lot.
That's what Graymore?
Yeah.
That's what Graymore called Joe back in his apartment.
Oh, that's right.
So they might have gotten it from him or from one of his cronies. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really freaking matter. What's funny is that one of the things I quibble about is, you know that octopus that's on Hank's face at the end?
Yeah.
And he's, like, holding it to his face. And he's like, oh, and it's like supposed to be the hilarious.
Struggles to like get it off because of the suction cup.
Okay. I watch a lot of Asian food videos. Right. So I've seen a lot of live octopus because it's a shock food. People like to take videos of it. So if they're like, shock in Asian food, you're going to get the live octopus thing. So I know that after an octopus is dead, it can move because of the way that their nerves work throughout their body. Right. But what they don't do is hang limply on somebody's face with the part where they cut out the guts showing towards the camera. So... That octopus was probably really, really dead, but also from Frozen. Not the movie Frozen. It was a frozen octopus that they purchased, thawed, and then held to his face.
Nice.
Isn't that weird? I was like, oh no, that's not problematic. Not as much as them like standing around like they are.
So then they go ahead and have dinner. There's like this stage show.
They're showing their history or what have you, but Nathan Lane has these bamboo fingers on. Mm-hmm. And he's got a huge headdress. His hand is painted not unlike the eyeball from the Pan's Labyrinth's eyeball hand monster.
Yeah. Like, and he like puts them like over his eyes.
Yeah. So go listen to that if you want to hear that rant. But like to see a hand on somebody's eye with like super long freaky fingers, I was like, oh, call back.
Yeah.
And then they're reenacting why they need to throw somebody into the volcano. And the bad spirit that inhabits the volcano has a head that's shaped like the factory that Joe escaped from to be here.
Mm-hmm.
It straight up has the same two weird round eyes and the gated mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much a box.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah.
But everything is like that octopus.
And then Joe shows up and Chief, played by Abe Vigoda, goes ahead and makes like one final call. And like before he like goes up, they have two people who like run into swing into gongs and then they get carried away on stretchers that are made.
They cut to Abe Vigoda and he's just like, he's got his hand to his head and he's like, ugh. I think at this point, Patricia says, where's Joe? And Vigoda's like, maybe he ran off, didn't want to jump into a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's like this big clamor from the crowd and you turn and there's Hanks in that fancy Armani tuxedo that he got with a puka, but not in a bad way, lei around his neck. And he's holding like a bottle of wine and like a cup and he's got like the moon or whatever. He's backlit. It's his most gorgeous moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I fully 100% approve.
Yeah.
So he comes and he sits down on the other side of the chief and she's like, a tuxedo? And he says, I thought if I had to go out, I'd go out in style.
Mm-hmm. And so none of the natives want to go ahead and jump into this volcano. And Joe is like, take me to the volcano. And they run this path up to the volcano. Yeah,
they have to follow a trail. It's got a sort of familiar look to
it. It's like all jaggedy.
Yeah, it's like thick at the bottom, right? But it spikes back and forth. It
looks a little bit like a lightning bolt.
A lightning bolt. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, so funny. Hitting you over the head. Hard.
Like a mainstay.
So at the volcano summit, Patricia stops the whole thing and makes this huge declaration of love.
Yeah.
She also Patricia, like on the boat where Joe's about to go to sleep, she asked Joe, did you have sex with my sister? And he was just like, no. And then later on at this point, she's like, I love him and I've never even had sex with him. And so I'm like, why are you so hung up on having sex with someone?
Because we're woke now and you can have sex without like ruining your life.
Right. And then Joe says that he loves Patricia and he's like, I've never felt so good in my entire life, but the timing stinks.
I've never been in love before either. It's great. I'm glad. But the timing sucks. So he kisses her and he leaves.
Yeah. And so she's like, well, just marry me then. You're going to have to love and honor me for like 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's pretty good. She calls the chief over to do it.
Yeah.
He's like... she's like, marry me. He's like, I don't want to get married. She's like, what are you afraid of? The commitment? You're going to jump into a volcano in like 30 seconds.
Yeah. And then they have like the best vows of all time.
Do you want to marry him?
Yes.
Do you want to marry her?
Yes.
You're married. I'm going home.
Yeah. And then Joe goes to jump in the volcano and...
So the entrance to the volcano, they're at the edge, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lip. They have like a plank that extends into the volcano with like a decorative arch that has a weird crocodile that doesn't make any sense. But the plank is a tongue, mm-hmm. like to a serpent. And so I think this is visually very cool. It's got two prongs to it. So he walks out to one and then...
She walks out to the other.
She goes, if you jump, I jump.
Yeah, because we're married. Where you go, I go.
I don't want you to do this because of me. And she says, I do what I want.
Yeah.
Which is, I love it because I like walk around when somebody's like, hey, can you whatever? And I'm like totally willing to do it. I'll be like, don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Like it's a certain catchphrase.
They say some like very poetic things. Joe says, you know, the first time I saw you, it felt like I've seen you somewhere before. And Patricia's like, you know, nobody knows anything. We'll take this leap and we'll see. And Joe at one point makes the note that it's like, I had been miserable for so long on a crooked road, and then I met you. And I'm just like, so this entire time, it wasn't a lightning bolt at all. It was a crooked road. I like a lightning bolt better.
Mm-hmm.
Better.
Yep.
And then Joe holds out his hand. Patricia goes from a closed fist to an open one and takes his hand. And then they jump.
But they don't jump for long, because here's what happens. They fall towards their fiery death, and we're thinking Gollum and Lord of the Rings, and we're all really relieved because it's been a long time coming.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about a volcano a lot and not doing anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
A plume of steam comes up from under them, which if it came from all that lava, would have scalded their skin off, but let's leave that science at the door because they fly over the volcano, which we assume is probably going to be on an island sustaining at least 50 or more people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say, like... 500 to 1,000 feet tall.
Yeah.
They are ejected out of this at a high arc. Oh my gosh. The CGI is they're green screen and they're like being propelled out of it. So their arms are like down by their sides and they're doing this weird flappy thing. Like I don't even know how you explain it to somebody.
It's like they were told by the director, okay, stand there on the green screen.
Uh-huh. And arms then, down. Keep them down. You don't know you're flying. You didn't expect this.
Right. And then go ahead and then just act like you would if you were being flown through the air while you're standing straight up.
I think I would just wobble a little bit. Like wiggle. My arms might flap a little bit. I'm going to be like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah.
But here's my problem, Lydia. They're flying 1,000 feet in the air down into the ocean. And I don't know if you watched Mythbusters, but after a couple hundred feet and probably way less than 1,000 feet, your squishy body meeting water is the equivalent of hitting concrete.
So at this point, you were really taken out of the movie. This was also the worst thing in the movie.
This, again, is where the science breaks down.
I'm sorry, but They should have died.
Oh, I know.
Oh, man. Okay. Now they're in the water. The smoke marks on her face, did you notice that they were perfectly blushed?
Yeah.
They just made her look like the corpse bride, not like she just got her butt blasted out of a volcano.
Yeah.
And he looked like a chimney sweep, but in an adorable way. Yeah. And he's like, what are you doing still alive?
She's like, what are you doing still alive?
And then they cuddle together.
And then Joe's like, I mean, we're in the middle of nowhere and there's no land in sight because the island starts sinking down.
The island sank, guys, because they were spit out. And then all of a sudden, the bags start popping up.
Patricia's like, we still have our lives. It could be okay. And then the luggage starts popping up and she's like, see?
And he goes, how did it do that? Fair enough. Because how did it get out of the ship 300 yards away from you? Mm-hmm. How did it, from wherever you were staying in the cabin, mm-hmm. show up like the half mile from shore
mm-hmm.
that you landed when you got blasted? The math is bad.
And then they turn it into a raft with their rope that was probably somewhere.
Maybe they decided to start keeping it in the luggage because the lamps are everything. They didn't take anything out of the luggage. So, like, they have it all. Maybe it was on the shore and when the thing rumbled. But then wouldn't they still be tied together? I'm
not going to try and make sense of this movie.
Okay.
I just want to get through it. We're almost done.
Okay.
And so then Joe says, you know, things might actually be okay, but I still have a brain cloud.
Father Ex Machina.
Patricia's like, well, what's that? And so he goes and he explains it.
You didn't get a second opinion on something called brain cloud?
Well, Dr. Ellison said.
Well, he's that quack. Dr. Ellis.
Yeah.
That's my father's physician. He's in his pocket. He doesn't work with anybody else.
So then we find out that this doctor who gave this, like, possible, like, brain cloud diagnosis.
The unsolved mystery is solved.
We have neighbors.
Sorry.
Okay, so now I'll tell you, because she said he's a quack, right?
Yeah.
Quack. There's a duck. There's a second duck. There's a third duck, right? A duck in French is called a canard, which is the same as a hoax.
Oh.
And a crazy doctor is called a quack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy doctor was a hoax.
You see the duck at the doctor, you see the duck with the dad, and then you see the duck on the island.
I don't know how the other two make sense to me in terms of, like, this weird thing I read in a wiki, right? But, like, the one on the island doesn't make any sense.
Not unless you were seeing this through Joe's perspective, and the duck is, like, a little, like, nod to himself saying that everything is fake, including him jumping into the volcano is going to save the island.
But then again,
it's still a white guy thinking that the beliefs of indigenous people is stupid.
But they like Fanta, so how indigenous are they?
Yeah.
Oh, God, problematic.
Anyways.
Okay, so here are problem solved. They don't have to jump in the volcano.
Yeah.
He does not have brain cloud.
Right.
They have their raft.
Right.
They are in formal wear.
Yeah.
They have a lamp.
Yeah.
And he's like, but now there's no land in sight and we're in the middle of the ocean. And she turns to him and says,
it's always going to be something with you, isn't it, Joe? And credit.
Well, also, like, he throws away the line, I don't know where we're going to end up, but wherever we do go, we should take this luggage.
Best line of the movie.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So.
And they lived happily ever after.
Oh, there was an end scene that was like, they live happily ever after.
Comic Sans.
Oh. So, I don't know. I got a few fun facts. When he runs into his office at the end, just before he quits, he turns this, there's a main pipe that goes through his office, and it says, do not touch, on a little sign on it, and you see him spin it really fast. And he's not opening it. He's closing it because righty tighty, lefty loosey. And he's like, nothing happened when I did that. And I'm like, not when you close something, but whatever. John Patrick Shanley, he puts a full moon into every piece of work he has. And we had like two or three, if not more, in ours. This film was inspired by a goofy cartoon, which I was going to make us watch before we like started the recording, but it's called Hello Aloha from 1952, and it's on YouTube, so you can find it.
Okay.
And then this movie cost $25 million and box officed $39.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made its money back.
Now let's yell at each other about it.
Okay, so shocked moments. For me, there were just like a lot. Like the fact that all of the women in Joe's life are the ones that have any romantic significance are all pretty much played by the same woman. You could very easily see that as like a you know, Joe sees all romantic women as the same. You know, that's maybe a shallow reading, but it, like, this was a moment where you could have had, like, other female actresses come in and play those different parts.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that was just, like one of the many things. I think my biggest shocked moment is how much I personally invested into this movie at a very early age.
Uh-huh.
And going back to it now as a 37-year-old, I'm just like, there are definitely some good elements to it, but it's really hard to enjoy those good elements when you have this horrible stereotyping and this horrible caricature of Indigenous people that, like, when you actually look at the history of people in the South Pacific Polynesian cultures, probably the best thing that ever came from this, for me watching this movie recently and doing the podcast on it, was the fact that it is inspiring me to learn more about these other cultures.
Yeah.
Solely because I'm like, this movie did such a poor job at trying to convey that information.
Well, and I think to piggyback on that, like, humor is cultural in a lot of ways. There's some things that we all find funny, but there are certain things within a culture that we'll find that is specific to them. Like, Germans do a lot of puns because their language is very literal. So, like, you'll have, like, a word that's, like, 18 words long because you're trying to describe a pickle fork, and it's just hilarious to them. It might not be as funny to you or I, right? The French, stereotypically, and all of these are stereotypes, because humor can be broad within a culture to an individual, but the broad stereotype is out there, too. Like slapstick comedy to the French, loved ironically. Totally a thing, apparently. What I think is irksome to me about this in terms of, like, the ethnic identity of these people is that, like, it was American humor on a non-American culture.
Yeah.
And it hit wrong.
Yeah.
And if it didn't hit wrong, it definitely hit unpleasant.
Yeah.
For this era. But 30 years is a long time. But that's all right. I think my shock is much more shallow, if you'd like to know.
All right.
It's all the dead people.
Oh, yeah.
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 We're talking upwards of at least 70 or so dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have an entire island that sank.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't near their boats. They were on the top of a mountain.
Yeah.
And then and they didn't show us a shot of people getting away on their boats.
Right.
And then there was the three crewmen who were on the boat, on the yacht.
Uh-huh.
And they're gone now.
Yeah.
One had a name.
Yeah, Dagmar.
Dagmar dead now.
Mm-hmm.
She's dead as that octopus. Yeah. And those fish Meg Ryan caught.
Yeah.
And all the dogs from movies you knew 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so all the dead people. Never mind.
Well, and even if, like, by some miracle they did actually get off the island, we've already been told that they have no sense of direction.
Screwed.
Yeah, screwed again by an author who did not need to screw them over so much.
We're going to end it on our applaud moments.
Yeah.
Unless you have a shocked moment you'd like to share, Jen?
No.
Okay, cool. Our applaud moment.
Yeah.
Do you want to go?
No, you go first.
Okay, so I'm going to pull one out of the air. I'm glad I saw this movie because I feel like I'm starting like Webster's defines movies as, okay, I think that what I liked about it was that when they took the time to have a character have room to breathe, they became a very good character. Like Marcos. Marshall?
Yeah.
I called him Marcos earlier. In part 10, 5 weeks ago, I said Marcos instead of Marshall, and I'm sorry because I don't remember characters' names, like, ever.
I should have corrected you back then.
That's okay. Marshall was only in a few scenes. He probably had less than 10 lines of dialogue, but he was fully fleshed, and he was not a caricature, and he wasn't a stereotype. And as much as he kind of, like, started off as rebuffing Hanks, like, he or Joe, he was like, once he got the feel of the character he was working with, he changed. And normally somebody so short doesn't have a big modification of behavior like that. I mean, it wasn't just that Joe bought him a suit. When Joe suggested him getting a suit, he was like, I can't afford that. And he wasn't greedy, because when Joe was like, do you want to have dinner with me? He's like, man, I got to get home to my kids. I'm not ungrateful for the day, but he was like, yeah, I'm this way. And then also, because I'm very, very, very shallow, not Taika Waititi, but Waturu, the boss.
Yeah, Waturi.
Waturi. He got to be a wholly unlikable character. Right. And I like to have one or two of those around so I can be like, that guy with the dandruff and the testicles on his desk, he got everything he deserved, right?
Yeah.
Also, that certain moments, like that Patricia's an independent woman, and she was like, I'm not jumping because of you. I couldn't figure out why she would jump, really, but that character trait stayed true mm-hmm. regardless. She's like, I'm just going.
Yeah.
Well, like, I'm down. When they gave the characters room to breathe, mm-hmm. they got to be, like, wholly themselves.
Yeah.
Also, Meg Ryan might just be the gem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely the MVP of the entire movie, in my opinion.
100%.
For me, it was all about the luggage guy. I mean, that is, like,
so good.
My applaud moment is so shallow because it was this one moment. I wish the entire movie was about him.
The timing, mm-hmm. the delivery,
yeah.
the way they interacted. You could tell that they both got the joke in a mm-hmm. way that didn't let you know that they had the joke.
Right. Beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Just best character.
Makes you want to buy some luggage.
Yeah.
How about you, Jen?
It was kind of refreshing to see something surreal like this.
Yeah, they were saying that it's more of a fantasy, like grown-up fantasy than it is something literal. Tried and true, like romance by rote.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, if I had to rank it between this, Sleepless in Seattle, and You Got Mail, I'd put this on top of You Got Mail.
I like You Got Mail better than this. And I've never truly appreciated Sleepless in Seattle, so that's either between them or on the bottom.
I don't think I've seen Sleepless in Seattle, and there are aspects to the movie that I like, but it feels like on the same page as this movie. I've never seen You've Got Mail, so I can't really speak to that. But I've seen like Sleepless in Seattle once, and I don't know if I would ever watch it again. Mm-mm. There's a movie that Sleepless in Seattle references, and I've seen that movie a few times, and that to me is like vagina fuel.
Is what?
Vagina fuel.
Wait, what?
Well, it's just, it's something that makes, it's like, it's specifically geared towards women, and it's like kind of super dramatic, but then there's this happy ending, and it's just like...
So you think that it's purely engineered for lady bonification?
Yeah, but the movie inside Sleepless in Seattle.
Oh.
I don't even remember the name of that one. Movie inside of a movie.
Like a play within a play?
Yeah, it's like an actual movie in our universe, though.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. I haven't really seen all three of the Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan films, so I can't really speak to, like, scale, but this is probably on the same page as Sleepless in Seattle, in my opinion.
This is probably up there for me in terms of, like, iconic romance movies that I've ever seen. I'm going to tell you this, Lydia. It has not changed my mind.
You know,
my job in the city is too hard.
I've definitely had, like, the few romance movies that I love.
Mm-hmm.
Like this movie, like when I rewatched it, I seriously questioned whether or not I should keep it afterwards. And I was like,
You know, it says something for me because I think my main squee moment was just seeing the daisy and the sunflower mm-hmm. in this movie. And that's just because we saw Harold and Maude from last month.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got super excited about that. Like we were watching it and I turn and look at Jen and I'm like, do you see it?
It just, this movie reminds me of, Lydia, at this moment, you could be watching Harold and Maude again. That's all I was thinking.
You could be rewatching it instead of watching this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, if you want to compare and contrast the next two, Jen could be editing for the next 47 years. But, like, they had such, and they had lots of cut scenes together, but not montages. And they had, a focus on two main characters as opposed to having... you know, at least three female leads mm-hmm. all played by the same person.
Right.
So spread out almost evenly throughout the entire film.
This is a completely different kind of romance and comedy but within Hollywood. Harold and Maude is a completely different kind of romantic comedy than Joe versus the Volcano, if you use those genres to describe.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, the things that we found taboo about Harold and Maude aren't the same things that we found taboo about this movie. So that makes a lot of sense, too. Like, it's just we're talking different eras and we're talking about different demographics in terms of like desired audience. And we're also looking at like, although I assume everyone is money grubbing, like ideas of different money pulls. They were expecting this movie to make a great deal of funds,
mm-hmm.
but lots of things I read referred to this as a cult film, and I don't know why.
Doesn't seem like a cult film to me. Like
there is a non sequitur thread of Tom Hanks in this movie that is the penultimate of Tom Hanks. His name is Joe Banks. There's a, and he was in this movie called Fighting Mr. Banks and Castaway. Come on, it's right there. Okay, maybe he doesn't dress up as Little Lady like he does in Bosom Buddies, but there's also he's got the long hair from Da Vinci Code in the beginning of the film, and everything warps around this one movie okay, for his career.
Here's a fan theory I have for you. I think they write Doctor Who episodes to be like really weird. Like they throw them out there, like they throw this name and that name and this happened, this event, and they're all just made up and they just to fill out the dialogue. But then I think like later on, other writers or maybe even the same writers go back to that original one and they're like, oh, they mentioned the Vashta Narada in this one. Let's make an episode where the Vashta Narada and they extrapolate from there. So what if Tom Hanks made this film and all he's done is written all the weird shit on index cards and gone back and every once in a while he pulls one out and he's just like, you know, it'd be great being stuck on an island. That was fun. I screamed a lot at the sky. And he throws that card behind him and he thumbs through his index cards
and
again.
And we take his character from Da Vinci Code to be able to solve how he's in all of these movies. And why Nick Cage isn't in this movie.
Yeah, here's what maybe Nick Cage is in this movie.
He's just playing Tom Hanks the entire time and
he's
don't know.
He's got a Tom Hanks mask on.
Nick Cage and Tom Hanks, have they ever been in the same
face off?
Have you ever seen them in the same place?
I know. Nick Cage is Tom Hanks.
Oh, that makes me feel so dirty. Just even saying it makes me feel dirty.
And you so saying it. The fourth film in this trilogy is City of Angels.
God bless it. I'm at that part where I'm like, oh no, we gotta stop. Plotters, we gotta stop. We gotta stop Nicolas Cage from being... Okay, look, should we just wrap it up?
Yeah.
I feel like you've been with us on a great journey of plotters.
Like, I mean, this is like, the climax of this podcast is better than the climax of the movie.
I mean, really.
Again.
You could be reading The Odyssey, Robinson Crusoe, or Romeo and Juliet right now, but you're here with us.
Don't watch this movie. You don't need to. Everybody on this movie has gone on to bigger and better things.
Watch this movie. Suffer. Okay, so I mean, thanks for being with us. We hope that you have a fantastic April, or mm-hmm. that it's been fantastic, and yeah. that you're looking forward to your May.
Yeah,
we're thankful for each and every one of you. Please reach out to us on our socials that Jenna lists for you at the end of this very, very episode, which is very, very right now. I'm Naomi McQuaid.
I'm Lydia Malcolm.
I'm Jen McQuaid.
I always want to do Jen's part. Thanks for patroning the peculiar.
You've reached the journey's end of our third episode of Season 3 of Plotter. Thank you for joining us through every jab, moaning through the endless montages, and riffing through the long roast of 1990s Joe vs. the Volcano. Hey, this is your audio engineer and brain cloud patient zero, Jen. Did you know that we currently average about 15 listens per week for each part of our episodes? We'd really like to get a cult following of our own. And you can help do that by leaving a review in your favorite podcasting app. That's the best way to lift us up in search results. We'll also be sharing our growth in listenership on Facebook and Twitter. So we hope you'll favorite our social links in this episode's description. We're a commercial-free podcast because of our own investments as well as listeners just like yourself. And for only $1 a month, you can help sustain us too. Search for Shocked in a Plot on Patreon or click our Support the Show link on shockedinaplot.com. We'll be back on May 5th with a brand new month-long review. From Shocked in a Plot, thank you for patroning the peculiar.
Yeah!